Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. It's the 27th of December, and so we continue with our 12 or maybe even 13 days of Christmas. And Dominic, your choice of an anniversary for the 27th of December, I think, is a kind of, it's a very seasonally appropriate one, isn't it? Because it's themed around port.
It is themed around port. So lots of people like port for Christmas.
Gives you and, worst hangovers, doesn't it?
No, I think that's quite wrong.
I just smell port and I get a hangover.
So I think you can drink a lot of port and not get... My brother once drank an entire bottle of port while having a bath.
Well, he presumably didn't drown in his bath.
No, I think it was a bottle of white port, he told me. And okay, he said he got out of the bath and he felt great.
And then, Dr. Johnson said port was the drink for heroes or something.
Something like, well, we're going to come on to port like drinkers. I've got some port, a good fact about port drinkers later on. So... Port, very popular in England, of course, in Britain. Not so popular elsewhere, not so popular in the States and whatnot, though I think it's taking off a little bit. But why? Why is it so popular in England? Do you know, Tom?
Is it our old alliance with Portugal?
It kind of is. So it comes back to something that happened on the 27th of December, 1703, which is called the Methuen Treaty. So we're in the War of Spanish Succession. So one of the kind of endless wars that we fought between the sort of mid-17th century and the late 18th century, well, Waterloo, with France. Basically war for, you know, it's like a colossal world war, isn't it, I suppose. And Portugal has actually been allied with the French, believe it or not.
What?
Yes, I know.
I thought they were always our allies.
I know we have some Portuguese listeners and perhaps they can explain themselves.
That's shocking behaviour.
If they're members of the Rest is History Club, they should declare themselves on the Discord chat and explain their conduct. Because at the beginning of this war, Portugal is allied with France. Now,
that's ruined my Christmas.
England gets most of its wine, obviously, from France. So it's sort of shipped over the Channel and stuff. But obviously, because we're at war with the French, we're not getting so much wine and so on. And so people are looking for alternative suppliers.
Is that because there's an official state boycott from France? No, or is it because we're patriotically refusing to drink it?
I think it's just more, yeah, I think it's sort of...
Hassle,
patriotism. Yeah. I don't think you could even enforce, I mean, there's lots of, most of the heyday of smuggling. So yeah. Whether a boycott could even be that strictly enforced.
And Dominic, we have an episode on smuggling coming up.
Very exciting. So we'll be discovering the answer to that question in the new year in our smuggling episode. But English travellers have already been to Portugal to suss out the wine trade there. So in 1678, a Liverpool wine merchant sent two representatives to a place called Viana do Castelo, which is just north of Porto. And they went to this will please you, Tom. They went to an abbey called Lamego, which is in the sort of port valleys, the great valleys of the kind of Douro. And the abbot there gave them what they called a very agreeable, sweetish and extremely smooth wine, which they have fortified with grape spirit. Mm-hmm. So it's a fortified wine. So it's port. And they say, oh, this is very nice. And they buy the whole lot of the abbey's stocks.
Wow. That is enthusiasm, isn't it?
Yeah. And bring it home. So they already know that there's some good stuff out there. And because it's fortified, it will last longer and survive the sea voyage better. So it's also better for taking to the colonies.
Yeah, of course.
Interestingly. So, 1703, the Portuguese don't like being allied to the French. This shows them in a very good light.
Yeah, they shouldn't.
And they're keen to change sides. And the guy who is Britain's ambassador to Portugal is a man called Sir John Methuen, who combines this job, interestingly, with being Lord Chancellor of Ireland.
Ooh.
So,
that's an obvious job pairing.
Well, it's a sort of Boris Johnson cabinet pairing, isn't it? Yeah, your Minister for Equalities and also Minister.
And Trade Minister.
Exactly. It's very much a kind of 21st century kind of appointment.
But I mean, possibly easier to do in the 21st century than the early 18th century.
Yes, I should imagine so.
Bay of Biscay, I mean, it's a rough sea.
Yeah, you're not going to want to be sailing between Lisbon and Dublin.
As we will find out when we come to my choice.
On a regular basis.
In the second half of this podcast.
You know why I think you would like this, Tom? Do you know where Sir John Methuen was from?
Wiltshire.
He was from Wiltshire.
Salisbury.
He was from Bradford-on-Avon.
Oh, was he? Yeah, wonderful. Anglo-Saxon town.
But do you know what Jonathan Swift said about him?
Something rude, I imagine.
A profligate
possibly
rogue.
Involving poo.
A profligate rogue without religion or morals, cunning enough, but without abilities of any kind.
Swift would be so good to have around at the moment.
He'd be a great guest for this podcast. That'd be wonderful.
He'd be rude about us.
He's dead, so he can't,
well,
he can't
we can
come
pretend.
Out. So anyway, Sir John negotiates this treaty with the Portuguese called the Port Wine Treaty, where they basically say they'll switch sides. The English will sell wool and cloth to the Portuguese.
This is very medieval.
And we will buy wine from Portugal and we'll put less duty on it than wine that comes from France, a third less duty. So this is tremendously good news for people who like port. And then the next few years, you get the establishment of so many of these kind of classic English port houses. You see them in Vila Nova de Gaia on the other side of the river from Porto. So Taylor's, Graham's, Coburn's, Sandyman's, all these Coughburn's. Kind of great houses. Yeah. Have you ever been to Porto, Tom?
No, I haven't.
I'd love to go to Porto.
I've actually only been to Portugal once. It's number one on my list of places I want to go to.
Portugal is a very fine country, I think.
Stopped off in Lisbon.
Lisbon is a fantastic city.
Which I thought was beautiful. And the whole of Portugal, it's just waiting to go.
Yeah. So there's a place in Lisbon called the Port Wine Institute. And it's basically like a gentleman's club. Back to our gentleman's clubs episode. And you can go in there. They've got like a huge wine list, which is just ports.
Well, I imagine as a member of Brooks's.
It's very
welcome me with open arms.
It's very good. Yeah, they'll love you, Tom. Yeah. Especially if you go in your nice suit that you wore to Brooks's, which I think is a bespoke suit, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, if you go in your bespoke suit, I think they'll be very impressed.
Yeah.
I think they've got your books in Portugal, don't they? Are they translated into Portuguese?
Yeah, some of them.
I remember going into...
That must have made your day.
So not long after I'd first met you, we went to Lisbon on holiday. And we went into this gorgeous bookshop, old-fashioned bookshop.
Mm.
And my heart sank like a stone. Because they had almost like a whole wall of Rubicon or Persian Fire or something.
It's not awful. Enough that you succeed, your friends must fail.
Exactly. What's awful.
So,
ruined the holiday.
So true. Yeah.
Anyway, back to the Methuen Treaty. It's very successful. So by 1717, Portuguese wines account for 2/3 of all the wines imported into England. And do you know how many wines in England were French?
5%.
4%, Tom. Very 4%. Close. 4%. Very poor.
How patriotic is that?
Very patriotic. Very impressive. So port became, in the 18th century, it was known as the Englishman's drink. And
was this good for Portugal as well?
Very good, because they're making loads of money. Yeah. They're giving lots of people employment and they're very happy.
So the 18th century, Britain is kind of booming, becoming the economic superpower.
Yeah.
So I guess
spending
good,
all our money on port. Hmm. So social clubs, obviously we've talked a lot about clubs in recent episodes because of course our own club, but the clubs, I don't know where, I think this is an innovation that we should introduce in the Rest is History club, because clubs would tout their membership of what were called three bottle men. So a three bottle man, unlike my brother, was a man who could drink three bottles of port in one sitting without disgracing himself. So the playwright Sheridan, he was a three bottle man.
He was a member of Brooks's.
As was Pitt the Younger.
So was Pitt the Younger.
Yeah.
So they were all in Brooks's, necking three bottles of port.
Three bottles of port.
I mean, and how does do you know how sherry ties in with this?
Sherry's from Spain. It's not from
Yeah,
Portugal.
It is. Jerez.
Jerez, exactly, yeah.
But I wondered, was it a kind of similar thing? Maybe we could investigate that.
Well, it's a similarly fortified wine, isn't it?
But it is, and there's a kind of similar close link between English traders and...
Yeah,
The suppliers in Spain. Maybe there is.
We should definitely do a podcast. It's been said to us several times by people on Twitter and so on that we should do a podcast on drinks. Yeah, on wine, on tea, on
Okay. Well,
because they have fascinating histories. So
as a listener, we'll tell. We'd probably need to do some research before we actually embark on that.
That's true.
But I agree. I mean, that is a fascinating theme.
Good.
And I mean, as I've said, I basically can a sip of port and I get.
Yeah, you're not a three bottle man.
I'm not.
What the hell are you doing?
So while you were giving this wonderful disquisition on port, I was actually checking the Dr. Johnson quote.
What, you weren't listening?
No, I was multitasking. And the actual quote is: "Claret is the liquor for boys, port for men. But he who aspires to be a hero must drink brandy."
Oh,
so yeah. We should maybe include one brandy as well.
We should, yes,
on our future subject. Okay, well, that was fascinating, Dominic. And I mentioned the Bay of Biscay and how violent the waves can be there, how bad the seasickness that you get sailing in a ship across the Bay of Biscay. And that ties in with my choice of an anniversary, which is 1831. And it's Charles Darwin setting off from Plymouth Sound out into the Atlantic, down through the Bay of Biscay, on the Beagle. So We'll come to Darwin setting sail on the Beagle after the break.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom Holland has set the scene very nicely for the voyage of Charles Darwin on the Beagle. Now, of course, Tom, you know that Charles Darwin was a great Salopian, like me, a son of Shropshire.
Yes, I do.
So I think Shropshire, I think there are the big four. There are the big four that people talk about. There's Charles Darwin. There's Robert. There's Clive of India. Mm-hmm. There's Carol Decker. There's Carol Decker of Tapao.
Yeah. Okay. And Sandbrook.
And there's me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no offense to no offense to Clive, fans of Tapao, or you, right. But I think of those what? Four,
shocking.
I think of those four, Charles Darwin is probably top Salopian.
So. Well, top Salopian.
I mean, Charles Darwin is a massive, massive figure, and he's a massive figure, obviously, because of theory of evolution, all that kind of stuff. Origin of Species, everything. And I absolutely think that we should do a podcast on Darwin and perhaps specifically on the voyage of the Beagle, because Darwin said by far it was that the voyage of the Beagle was by far the most important event in his life. Because before he left on the Beagle, he was basically a man who was in training to become a clergyman. So he was from the kind of prosperous background, wasn't entirely sure what to do. So I suppose a bit like today, kind of posh people with good educational backgrounds who don't quite know what to do. I mean, what do they do? Become lawyers or management consultants or something.
Yeah.
Back then, basically you become a clergyman. So because a clergyman was kind of, it was a nice job. You'd have a nice rectory. You'd have time to follow your pursuits. And in Darwin's case, those pursuits basically revolved around, first of all, natural history. So he was a great enthusiast for beetles. He loved kind of, you know, collecting beetles. Yeah. He a great botanist. I mean, he loved it all.
I've thought of somebody else who came from Shrewsbury who was...
Dominic!
Wilfred Owen. He was very interested in beetles, in fossils, and collecting things.
Okay, anyway, well, he probably comes second to Darwin.
That's a complete sidetrack.
Yeah, okay. So Darwin's very interested in natural history, but he's also very recently become interested in geology. And this is a time where the study of geology is it's kind of explosive infancy. People are going out into the wilds of Devon or Wales or Scotland, and they're mapping out the history of rock. And Darwin is obsessed by this, and really that's what he wants to devote his life to. But the academic posts, the careers that would enable him to follow a career in natural history or in geology aren't open. So essentially, the clergy is the only way in. So he's feeling kind of a bit depressed about that. Ideally he'd like not to become a clergyman. He'd like to devote his life to studying the natural world. But there's no kind of opportunity. And then in 1831, early summer of 1831, opportunity does come knocking in the form of an invitation to go on board a ship called the Beagle. As basically a kind of gentleman's companion.
Who's the gentleman?
So the gentleman is a man called Robert Fitzroy, who is the captain of the Beagle. And he's a impeccable background. He's a stern Tory. And this is a time of great political convulsion because the massive debate about the Reform Act that's going, roiling Parliament all through 1831. He is the nephew of Lord Castlereagh, who was the Foreign Secretary.
Yeah.
Negotiating with the Congress of Vienna.
Not popular with
Byron and Shelley. Yeah.
Yeah.
And who notoriously committed suicide, so slit his throat. And Fitzroy is nervous about this because he's worried that, is depression something that runs in the family? And the reason he's particularly worried about this is that the captain of the Beagle, who had gone on the previous voyage down to South America, which is where the Beagle is planning to go, he'd got to the Magellan States and he'd found it so depressing and boring that he'd shot himself.
Oh God, that's not really a recommendation.
So Fitzroy is nervous about this. He doesn't want to be the only gentleman on the boat because as a gentleman, he can't invite people who aren't gentlemen to dine with him. So that would be miserable. And the plan is that this is going to be a 2-year voyage to kind of map out the coastline of South America, perhaps even longer, perhaps go around the world, which in the event is what they do. In the event, it's a 5-year voyage. He wants a companion, and that's basically the prime consideration. But on top of that, because they're going to these strange lands with strange flora, strange fauna, strange geology, the ideal is someone who could tick all those boxes. And basically, Darwin is the most perfect person imaginable. He's of the right social standing, and he's of, he's got the right kind of scientific expertise.
And is he quite a gregarious person, though, Tom?
He is quite a gregarious person, but he's a Whig.
Right.
So this is a time about politics. Well, this is a time of heated political debate. So that's a shadow. But there are all kinds of shadows that hang over before Darwin gets signed up. The first problem is that his father doesn't approve. His father thinks that this is equivalent of, going off on a gap year or something. Don't go off to Thailand or something to smoke pot on a beach. Get a decent job, get a haircut. It's that kind of attitude. And it's Darwin's uncle who recognizes the opportunity that this presents, and how perfect it is, and how absolutely wonderfully it maps onto all Darwin's interests. And so he basically kind of pushes it, and Darwin's dad is one round. The next problem is Darwin goes rushing down to London to meet Fitzroy, who says, "Oh, I've offered it to a friend of mine. Sorry, but you're next in line." And Darwin is thrown into despair, absolute misery. He'd kind of completely committed himself to going. And then the next day, Fitzroy comes around and says, "My friend doesn't want to do it. Oh. To come." And this is all in London. It's all against the backdrop of the coronation of William IV and this kind of great convulsive political debate about should reform go through. So it's a time of immense excitement. And it's a time where disagreements between Whigs and Tories would be at their most electric. So it's kind of like imagining a Brexiteer and a Remainer having to go on a ship for 5 years together.
Nigel Farage and AC Grayling.
Yes, exactly.
It's a great TV show, isn't it?
But I think maybe because Darwin is so desperate to go, maybe because Fitzroy is so desperate to have, someone go with him who wants to go, they kind of agree to get on with each other. And it's agreed that Darwin will go. So that's all very exciting. So Darwin now has to get ready. He has to ready himself. So he hares around England saying goodbye to all his friends, talking to various scholars who can kind of provide him with expertise. So he buys the most up-to-date microscope. He buys the best shotguns, because, of course, a crucial part of natural history is shooting animals, skinning them, and then stuffing them. So taxidermy is a vital part of natural history at this point. He invests in a copy of The Principles of Geology, which is the first volume by Charles Lyell, which is this kind of groundbreaking text, which argues that rather than the Earth having been shaped by, floods and apocalypses, as the Bible suggests, that actually the processes of geological change are incredibly, incredibly slow, incredibly, incredibly profound. And this will be very, very important for Darwin over the course of the 5-year voyage, because he will be reflecting on just how profound the processes of change can be. Yeah. And obviously he starts applying these principles from the field of geology to that of natural history. And that's kind of a crucial part of what will inform his theory of evolution. So he's getting all his stuff together. He gets taken by Fitzroy then to go and look at the Beagle. So they go from London, they go on a kind of steam packet round Kent along the south coast, and they arrive at Devonport. And this is where the next blow to Darwin's confidence comes, because the Beagle turns out to be really tiny.
So how big? How big is the Beagle?
It is, I've noted it down here, let me see. It's 90 feet by 24. And there are two tiny cabins, one of which, which they will have to share. And basically Darwin's quite a big man, so he's difficult to cram himself into the hammock. So he's kind of thinking, 2 years, 3 years, do I really want to do this? And he kind of havers for a couple of days, and then he thinks, oh, no, damn it, of course I do. And then he becomes as enthusiastic as ever. The months go by, he's been rushing around, sourcing all his gear. He's got to arrive in Plymouth, which the ship is going to sail from. And they're due to sail on the 5th of November, so Guy Fawkes Day. Darwin arrives there on the 24th of October. Absolutely terrible storms. They just kind of blow and blow and blow. And the leaving date has to be cancelled. And they just blow all the way through November. And then on the 21st of November, one of the sailors, so there are 73 people in all are going, and one of them gets blown overboard and drowns. And Darwin has a kind of massive panic attack. And, you know, later, all through his life, Darwin will be prone to panic attacks, these kind of strange stomach complaints that grip him all the way through his life. And this is kind of early onset of his panic attacks. And he's like, oh, should I do it? Should I do it? But again, he thinks, yeah, of course I've got to do it. I've got to do it. Finally, the 10th of December, there's a clear day. And Fitzroy says, okay, let's go. Let's go, boys. They all board, sail out into the channel. Terrible, terrible weather. And Darwin discovers that he can't cope with storms.
God.
And it's projectile vomiting all across his cabin.
If I was Fitzroy, I'd have got rid of him.
It's awful.
They've only got two cabins, a 90-foot ship. I mean, the last person you want is like a big man who doesn't fit in the hammock. Yeah, who doesn't fit in the hammock.
Who gets seasick.
And also banging on about Brexit.
Yes. Well, he's not banging on about, because it's the other way around, isn't it? He's the Remainer.
He's banging on about the Great Reform Act.
Yes. Well, he's not. He's banging on about geology and stuff, which Fitzroy is interested in. Anyway, so the next day, it's the weather's so bad that Fitzroy turns around and they go back. And Darwin has his clothes washed, and, you know, the cabin is scrubbed, and they all agree to forget about the seasickness. 21st, another clear day. So Fitzroy says, okay, let's go. Let's set off. They set off. The weather is calm. Darwin goes to bed. He fits himself, squeezes himself ass first into his hammock. He has a good night's sleep.
Right.
He wakes up. He reaches for his compass, studies it, and to his consternation realizes that they're sailing back to England. And the reason for this is that a terrible new storm is approaching them, sweeping down the channel. So they dock in Plymouth, the storm comes in, and all over they have a miserable Christmas because it looks like they're never going to set sail. And then finally, on the 27th, off they set. And they head out and they get into the Bay of Biscay. And in the Bay of Biscay, terrible, terrible weather. Darwin is just kind of sick day after day after day. But they keep heading southwards. You know, they cross the equator. They reach South America. They reach Tierra del Fuego. They reach the Galapagos Islands. They cross the Pacific. Head 5-year voyage. They come back to England. And Darwin comes back loaded down with all kinds of specimens of butterflies and the skeletons of giant ground sloths that he's picked up in South America and beautiful feathers and all kinds of things. But above all, he's come back with the thoughts and theories that will come, an idea that will change the world.
Very good. Tom, I cannot believe that what this confirms to me is how foolish you are in not reading those Aubrey Mattirin novels of Patrick O'Brien.
Well,
tell that story and it's pure Patrick O'Brien.
Well, so the film which I saw, what's it, Master and Commander?
Yeah.
The guy, the one played by, the Paul one Bettany. Who's not Russell Crowe, by Paul Bettany, it seemed to me pretty clearly modelled on Darwin. Because they go to the Galapagos Islands, don't they?
Yes,
And the relationship, I imagine, because The Voyage of the Beagle is a great book, you know, he writes it up. Mm. Fitzroy writes an account as well. I imagine that must perhaps be lurking in the background of those novels. I mean, they're set a bit later, but not that long. I mean,
it's sort of 30, 40 years between the two events, I suppose, isn't it?
You know, there's kind of, they get fired at, I think, in the River Plate. The Royal Navy is there kind of keeping an eye on British commercial interests there, and they get shot at. You know, Darwin... Yeah, I think there's kind of possibility there.
One of your New Year's resolutions to have another stab.
I mean, the relationship ultimately between Fitzroy and Darwin does become quite combustible, because actually the first huge row that they have is about slavery. Fitzroy is a defender of slavery.
Right.
Darwin, of course, who comes from a family of abolitionists, yeah. was appalled by that. So there's all kinds of kind of fascinating dynamics, fascinating kind of aspects to that voyage.
We should over definitely
and
above.
Yeah, it's a really rich and the book to read on it, which I got all the information from this, is Biography of Darwin by Adrian Desmond and James Moore, which is not just the best biography of Darwin, it's one of the great, you know, all-time biographies. It's a wonderful book. So I think we should definitely look to do that.
Very good. All right.
Okay.
Well, that's a jolly note on which to end. Lots of reading. And
yeah, and I hope that that's the kind of episode that makes you glad that you're not on a cramped and tiny cabin in the Bay of Biscay.
Yeah, because, of course, by the time this goes out, we may be in some form of lockdown.
Yeah, we may be.
So, you know, no matter how grim it is, you're not on the Beagle with Darwin being sick in your face. So, yeah. You know, it swings around.
Projectile vomiting.
Yeah. Right. We will see you tomorrow for more exciting anniversaries in the 12 days or 13 days of Christmas. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.